Reach out to them.
Not just simply the 19th century, and recapturing, let's say, the broader spectrum and lines of structure. So in that sense, I think the Fourth Symphony really was a departure for me in terms of the other orchestral pieces that had preceded it.
Let's hear the beginning of it, and this is George Rochberg's Symphony No. 4 with the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Willem Sokal. We've heard the beginning of George Rochberg's Fourth Symphony, as performed by the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Willem Sölkal. George Rochberg is my guest. You've been called a neo-romanticist. I'd like to know what you think of the use of that term.
Well, it's an odd term, you know, because the 20th century has been full of neo-this and neo-that. And I suppose what people are trying to say with these almost slogan-like phrases, they're trying to suggest that there is a connection, perhaps a serious connection, you know, between, if you say, neoclassicism, which was the epithet that was hurled at Stravinsky. People, I suppose, were trying to say, well, it sounds like the old classical music. But of course it's not. And neo-romanticism is a curious phrase because it suggests that what composers are trying to do, if they are writing, let's say, tonal music, which begins to sound melodic and has a clear structural line that you can follow, that this evokes all kinds of associations with earlier 19th century music. I am not ashamed in the least of any sense of association between, let's say, what I've written in the last 10 years or so and the 19th century. The only difference in my mind is that the so-called romantic, the new romantic movement, which is supposed to be moving along these days, comes out of a reaction against modernism. And that's a very, very different thing from, let's say, just simply bypassing a modernist notion or a modernist aesthetic and trying to make some kind of connection, superficial or deep, with the old music. I can't speak for other composers because I think everyone who's writing either tonal music or a kind of mixed tonal, atonal music, which also preoccupies me because I'm not strictly, I haven't just gone from one extreme to another extreme. What strikes me as the essential difference, at least in my work, is the darkening of the musical palette. And this is, for me, very important because it means that in giving up, let's say, the more obvious possibilities with modern music, you have to go inside. Now, that may sound like a kind of an odd thing. All art comes from inside, one way or the other. But it's a question of, you know, how far deep inside you go. One of the things which I think is not widely talked about, although I think that some composers that I have talked with about this are as aware of it as I am, and that's the connection between the impulse, let's say, to write a new kind of music and what's creating the particular quality and texture of that impulse, whatever the personal differences are from composer to composer. And I think we're pretty much all agreed that what's creating that impulse is that the new romanticism, if we insist on the, you know, that phrase, I don't personally, although I wouldn't deny, of course, that I am a romantic composer. I've always been a romantic composer, one way or the other. But the impulse really comes from a time when we're under the threat of nuclear destruction. And there's so many aspects to this particular time which are totally debilitating to most people. You might almost say the wreckage of our civilization, which shows up in many, many different ways, some more advanced than others. In wanting to write this kind of music, what we're really affirming is life. That's a quite different thing from the kinds of impulses, let's say, which affected Brahms at the end of the 19th century, or a Mahler or a Bruckner. It's not that they were not also affirming life. But we see, for example, in Mahler, I've always had the feeling that the almost near heartbreak quality of his music comes from his own awareness that his civilization, his time, is breaking up. He doesn't know what's going to follow. His peculiar intuitions are all too right, in a sense. When you realize he died in 1911, 3 years later, in August of 1914, the first guns of the First World War went off, and that was the real beginning of the 20th century. I mean, if you take the calendar 1900 as the beginning of the 19th century, it's not quite true, culturally speaking. But if you take the beginning of the breakup of the old world with the First World War, that's when you really have the true characteristics of the 20th century. So some 70 years later, we find ourselves, I find myself, struggling with the realization that our world is also now in terrible trouble, great trouble. And there's no way in which the arts can affect it. I'm absolutely convinced that while art is necessary to the existence of a civilization and to the existence of individual people and large groups of people who love painting, love music, literature, and so on, but we cannot really affect the basic direction and nature of the political movements which are going on in the world, which have no particular concern for, let's say, let's call it the life-asserting forces. I mean, all the militarism which is going on right now in America, the arming, the saber rattling, the breakdown of talks with the Soviet Union. I find this all very profoundly disturbing. And if it doesn't, put me under a psychological cloud, and I can somehow cut through this miasma of you know, troubled sensations, then I can work. And that's the hard thing. And perhaps it was maybe just as hard to work in the late 19th century. I don't know. But certainly Mahler's work, in Mahler's work, you sense that something is ending. Now, the other side of this whole thing, of course, is that in a peculiar way, I also feel something new is beginning. And that, of course, its life, its capacity to send out a trajectory into the future depends absolutely on what happens in terms of the, you know, the larger political picture of the world. But if this new thing, this new impulse, has half a chance, I think we will see a really marvelous art again. Because what we're doing, in a sense, is working from the ruins of modernism. I once had a dream, and I sometimes dream, we all dream visually, but at the end of a dream, sometimes the dream is, how shall I put it, captured in a verbal phrase. And this particular phrase was the bright, shiny ruins of modernism. And that juxtaposition of the bright, shiny, but ruins of modernism is precisely where we are right now. And I think
you mean
all
musically
artists, in all the arts, uh-huh. I'm convinced in all the arts, the necessity to somehow find a way out, to assert these larger feelings again.
George Rochberg is my guest. What do you think are some of the failings of modernism that people want to find a way out of now?
Well, there are many, but I think to generalize, at least, and to talk briefly, because you can appreciate the fact that this is an enormous subject. I don't think it's ever been understood, certainly not by those of us who are living it, and maybe in another 50 or 75 years. But among the things that I find which are clear earmarks of or benchmarks of modernism are, for example, the profound tendency to reductionism, so that at the end of, let's say, a whole cycle of wildly oscillating movements back and forth, starting from about 1910, you end up with what we call minimalism, where if you look at a canvas, it's all black or it's all white. Or if you hear a piece of music, what you hear are, you know, very elemental, repetitive figures. Now, all of this may be very appealing, and apparently it is to some people, but its appeal can't last for very long, because art, it seems to me, has to have those layers which not only bring you from the surface of the work into the work, but as you move more and more into the depths of the work, you get more and more residue from it. It affects the visual memory, it affects the verbal memory, it affects the oral memory, if you're thinking about music. See, one of the biggest problems about 20th century music in terms of modernism is that very little of it can be remembered. That's an odd thing. It struck me a long time ago what a painful thing to be involved as an artist. And I take it as a given that all artists are serious people. I've never met one who really wasn't. But how painful to spend a lifetime producing work which, let's say, leaves nothing on the retina of memory. And that's one of the very serious flaws of modernism. Then, of course, you can see that the tendency toward abstractionism. You know, there are many ways of performing abstractionism in art. You can go from, it's easier in a way to talk about, let's say, Kandinsky. Kandinsky's wild, wonderful early 1913-14 landscapes, which tend toward abstractionism. But then when he turns in 23 to a kind of, it's not cubistic, but it's more geometric. It's cold, very ordered, very clear, but there's circles and squares and triangles and so on, intersecting, and so almost a spatial kind of image. But these are the things which begin to erode the emotional content. And if you were to compare, if it were possible to measure, let's say, the emotional content or the depth of emotional content in, oh, a Cezanne, for example, whom I love, with, let's say, a minimalist. Well, you'd just on a scale of 10, you'd be going from 10 for Cezanne all the way down to 0 for the minimalist. This would have nothing to do with the judgment, the aesthetic judgment, as to whether the work is valid or not as art, but just simply in terms of what you can look at, what you can think about, what you can carry away with you. Well, if you, let's say now, apply that to a musical situation, and you think of what you can take away with you from a Beethoven, from a Mozart, from a Mahler, from a Bruckner, and whether you can take anything away at all from, let's say, composers who have insisted absolutely on the most extreme forms of avant-gardism.
You want to give some examples of the composers you're thinking of?
Well, for example, and it's curious, in almost every case, we're talking about composers who were most active in the 50s and 60s. And if I do talk about avant-gardism or modernism, I'm really talking about the climax of the movement. Because you have to separate modernism into periods. Now, I'm no historian, but of course Stravinsky and Schoenberg and Béla Bartók, they're modern. But they were tied to their past. They were 19th century people. They were born in the 19th century. And they were still thinking in terms of the composers of that time. But if you say Boulez, you see, or if you say Stockhausen, or if you say Berio, these are composers who really come to first consciousness after the Second World War. And, of course, they are the European avant-garde, and they had a very profound effect, in a way, on American music after the Second World War. And as this music went on, it was very ingenious in its construction. See, these are great constructioners. But it's one thing to, let's say, think about the constructional elements of a Brahms symphony, which are quite fantastic, you know, really quite amazing. But they are simply the strut or the skeletal or the armature through which or on which, you know, the real life of the work exists. But if all you end up with, and this, of course, is the work of abstractionism, is an awareness of the intellectual structure, well, you can't really think about that too long without beginning to want something else, without beginning to wish that there was something more warm and warming about the experience. So I found myself, in the early 60s, beginning to turn violently away from all of this, which had fascinated me.
Well, you said that you felt serialism was even liberating when you started to work in that form. How could it be that it first felt liberating and then felt constricting? What was liberating about it when you started?
Well, it's curious that I approached serialism from a totally non-intellectual point of view. And in order to be a serial composer, I mean, you've got to, in fact, deal with that side of it because it demands a great deal of just sheer brain work and brain power. I approached it emotionally. I discovered about 1948, 49, and this is after I had first come to grips with Schoenberg. You see, Schoenberg was like a huge mountain that everyone had to deal with, whether they liked it or not. You either went around him or over him, if you could, or through him in some, you know, magical way. But you had to contend. You couldn't just turn away from him because he occupied such an enormous space on the musical landscape. And what I found fascinating about Schoenberg was not so much initially, that is, not the constructional elements, which turn out, of course, to be absolutely amazing and brilliant, and still probably among the very best serial music ever written. But I found myself fascinated by the emotional violence. A phrase comes to mind of a friend, an old friend. She once used it in relation to an early piece of mine. She said it was radiantly violent. Well, that's a term which I think can apply very readily to Schoenberg. And also, this linked up with necessities of my own, which had begun to come to the fore after the war, and I began to feel that I needed to break away from a more conservative bent, which I had been pursuing before the war and as a student right after the war. And so when I began to write 12-tone music, or what later became known as serialism, and of course, as you know, serialism is essentially a very particular way of ordering or bringing structural order into the 12 chromatic notes. It means that you give up the idea of the simple scale, let's say the C major scale or the C minor scale, and the key. Serialism attempts to impose other kinds of order than key, so that you no longer have a tonality, you have non-tonality. It's almost a kind of a negative condition. And that's the way, in fact, Schoenberg and Berg and Webern approached it. So what was liberating for me was that it gave me the expressive means with which to say the things that I was beginning to feel just around the time I was turning 30, 31. And the curious thing is that if I hadn't had that emotional internal pressure to go in that direction, I don't think I would have ever bothered, because the purely constructional or constructivist aspects are hardly worth the candle in their own terms. But see, what happened, and this is another flaw, I think, in the developing modernist idea, those things which were originally means, and they were means for Schoenberg and the others, became ends. And that's why they became so prominent, really, or surrealism became such a prominent way among academic composers, among which I hasten to add I never considered myself, even though I spent almost, 25 years at the university. But the sharp difference between, let's say, expressiveness or expressive means and structure is, I think, what determines whether or not you're one kind of composer or not in the 20th century. Whereas in the 19th century, you can't separate them. You really can't.
My guest is George Rochberg, composer, if you're just joining us. And I'd like to play part of another one of your symphonies, and we're going to hear the second part of the second symphony. This is from the 1960s. Maybe you can discuss this piece for us in terms of the issues you've just been going into.
Yes, well, I'd be glad to. Actually, it was written in 1955, 56, and it still stands for me as, one of my major statements, but not because it's 12-tone. Far, far, far from it. Because essentially it's a very powerfully expressive piece. Now, I can't say what it's expressive of, but perhaps in a sense the term radiant violence applies to it. It's a very intense piece. It's in one movement, which would say there are four sections which take the place of the traditional four movements, but there is no stopping and starting. One of the problems, too, I just might touch on this, that the 20th century has made possible, and this I see as an absolutely valid and viable way to think, and I'm sure it will continue. It certainly does for me, and that is generally the 19th century and 18th century composers tended to write, if they were writing multi-movement pieces, you started and you stopped. You started and you stopped. You started and you stopped. Now, that's much, much more serious a problem than, let's say, the ordinary layman might think it is, because you've got to get something going, and then you've got to know how to bring it to a close. And it's curious, as much as I love Brahms, there are pieces of his where the ending is, for me, not satisfying, because what he does is aborts it, mm-hmm. You see. So in its place, what's happened is the possibility of writing, I suppose, what you might call a looser structured, more fantasia-like work, where you don't stop and start or start and stop, but you start and you have these, let's say, open-ended spots and something new comes out of it. So the piece really is continuing. And so what that means is there's got to be one ending and only one ending. And in this particular work, the ending for me is perhaps its best structural aspect, you see, as well as expressive.
Well, we'll be hearing the beginning of George Rochberg's Symphony No. 2 with Werner Tarkanovsky conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. We've heard the opening passage of George Rochberg's Symphony No. 2, performed by the New York Philharmonic with Werner Tarkanowski conducting. George Rochberg is my guest, and he lives in suburban Philadelphia. For 23 years, he was on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania, where he also for several years was the chair of the music department. He recently retired from the university. You were saying before that one of the things that modernism does is challenge the conventions of music. And I think that that's a kind of constant process in any art, that a movement comes along, challenges the basic assumptions of it, breaks it, maybe pares it down to its basics, and then things are built in it again. Having been through serialism and then left it, are there any other conventions that you're still happy to do without, that being a temporary serialist enabled you to get out of or helped you to challenge?
Well, this is a very big question and has enormous implications. Without, you know, spending a lot of time talking about what preceded the modern period, I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that whatever happened from, let's say, the time of the Baroque on until the end of the 19th century or the turn of the century, the crossover into the early 20th century, there was really essentially only one language, and that was the tonal language, from a certain both structural, integral, and emotional point of view. The tonal language is the most stable language that the West has produced to this time. It's impossible to talk, for example, about modern music without realizing, or certainly at least pointing to, the fact that when modernism arose in music, which is in the first decade of the 20th century, it happened simultaneously in all the arts. And it didn't happen in America, it happened in Europe. In recent years, I've come to realize myself, and I talk about the fact that modernism begins as a European cultural revolution, kind of a consciousness explosion. The Europeans were, let's say, the recipients of an incredible series of artistic traditions. But something happened in the early 20th century. It may have something to do with the breakup of the political situation, with the breakdown of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was, of course, the result of the First World War. Whatever the specific causes are, the point is that there was an enormous need to break with the past. And in giving up the past, all of the ways of working, let's say, musically, or working as a painter, or writing as a novelist and a poet, all of these things underwent an enormous change, total revolution of a kind, so that when modernism began to search out the various different ways that it could proceed without falling back at any point on the conventions of, or the traditional conventions of the 19th or 18th and 19th centuries, it's almost as though everyone proceeded by negative impulse rather than positive impulse. And this legacy, which my generation and composers younger than mine and artists similarly in the other media, is a very difficult thing, because it means that having gone from the positive aspects of a very stable way of working, which allowed, let's say, all kinds of individual stylistic personal tendencies without disrupting the language, you go from that to the disruption of language, and everyone is off on his own trying to create his own language and his own way, but always with the shadow of the past on him and the clear consciousness that you can't go back to these things. Well, what happened to me and what other composers are beginning to feel, and for example, if I can just mention here that I read recently that Frank Stella, who was a young painter and well-known in this country, about 48, maybe 49, is now talking about what painters lost when they gave up Caravaggio and what they lost when they gave up Rembrandt and so on. Now, he was an absolute abstractionist. He was probably the second or third generation abstract expressionist, you know, the New York school. This sense of what had been given up, and whether it's attached to guilt or sense of loss, it's hard to say, but this is part of the battle to reclaim these things. So, for example, when I started to write tonal music again, and it took about almost a decade from the time I first got the impulse, the necessity, the desire to do this in a serious way, until the point where I really could do it and manage it in a way which was my own, what happened was that you had to reclaim, let's say, the aspects of the old music.
But doesn't that keep it alive? If there wasn't the avant-garde always challenging the conventions of an art, you'd be following them not because you wanted to necessarily, but because you had no choice and you were expected to, and at that point it becomes mannerism. So if it's constantly being challenged and then you reaffirm it, isn't it end up being a much more personal, committed statement?
I agree, and from the point of view, you know, that your question implies, we could say we owe a great deal to the avant-garde for having raised the question in such a serious way that it forced us to re-examine, in fact, what the situation was, what the true nature of the situation was in purely artistic terms. And in this sense, I don't even mean cultural. I mean artistic in the way that any one of us who's trying to make art has to work. But you see, you don't, unfortunately, it would be wonderful if, in fact, it could be so, that you arrive at a decision or a level of decision, and that's it. You know, there you are. You've achieved this ultimate plateau. It doesn't happen that way. Because once you've made one inroad into the solution of the problem, it brings with it all kinds of other questions. And so I find myself, for example, now beginning to think that there is something else that must happen as a result of, let's say, the confrontation of this new attitude, call it new romanticism or whatever you like to call it, and the old avant-garde. And that is that we have to eventually confront the fact that having passed through the period that we're now engaged in, trying to, let's say, personally express these life-asserting forces, we're going to have to find a more precise way of structuring all this. And that, I think, is going to take us into what, for lack of a better term, you might call again the new classicism. But this would have nothing to do with the neoclassicism that, let's say, was typical of Stravinsky in the 1920s. This would not be an aping of a Bach or a Mozart, or it would go deeper than that in the sense that it would have to do with how you structure your ideas and how you balance the subjective side and the objective side. See, one of the problems is that we have flip-flopped back and forth from pure subjectivism to pure objectivism, and this is enough to make you dizzy. If you start thinking about it, and thinking about it in terms of specific works or specific artists, composers, painters, and so on, it's like watching a speeded up ping pong game in purely cultural terms.
I'd like to play another passage from one of your recent pieces, and we're going to hear part of Imago Mundi. Would you discuss what's happening in this piece?
Well, this again is a totally different kind of piece, and this follows pretty rapidly on the heels of the third quartet, which was the piece with which I sort of, you might say, I broke through into the area of tonality that I'd been trying to get to for a long time. And the reason why it's different is because It's less structural in the more obvious sense of the term and more imagistic, which is to say that the music, how shall I put it, the music focuses on images which have to do with texture and color and repetitive figures rather than a line which starts and takes you through, you know, a whole adventure. In that sense, the piece is different. But I think what characterizes the difference of the Imago Mundi and the other works around it, because that was written in 73, is the fact that a large part of this music derives from my then very new fascination with Japanese music, and specifically the ceremonial music of the court, the, what they call gagaku music. I did not use any traditional instruments, but I found a way, I think, to make the Western orchestra not sound like the Japanese instruments, but it would be a kind of how a Westerner, let's say, filters through the experience of the Japanese qualities.
Let's hear the beginning of Imago Mundi, written by my guest, George Rockberg, and performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with conductor George Salty. We just heard part of Imago Mundi, written by my guest George Rockberg, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with George Schulte conducting. That's a really interesting piece. Did you travel to the East, or is it just through listening that?
No, this is the one time in my life when I did travel, when I was deeply affected by the culture. I mean, if an American goes to Europe, pretty much, even if you've never been there, but you're going to recognize a lot of things. But if you go to Japan, as I did in 1973, it was a marvelous experience in every way. And it just opened me up to all kinds of things which I had felt. I mean, I had had some experiences, we all do, with haiku, and I'd seen some of the work of Japanese artists like Hiroshige and Hokusai, and enjoy them very much, and found them very fresh in their way of hitting the eye and their way of depicting things. Specifically, I fell madly in love with no drama and the various kinds of music that surround the ceremonial performances in the old court. What I did find, to my surprise and somewhat disappointment, was that most Japanese are less interested in these old traditional things than, let's say, I was. It was very difficult finding the actual theater where they were going to do this, you know, performance of No. But we did finally manage to get there. And so after coming back, when we returned, and I had to write this piece for the Baltimore Symphony, I felt, well, this is one time when I'm going to let the effect of another culture really move through me. So this was the end result.
You've retired from the University of Pennsylvania after 23 years of serving on the faculty, several years of serving as chairman of the music department, composer in residence. Is it changing your life a lot to not have that the constant workload that you have when you're on the faculty of a university?
Well, the only major change, Terry, is that now I can concentrate absolutely on my own work.
Is it easier to concentrate with that amount of time, or is it distracting to have?
Oh, I've longed for it all my life.
Uh-huh.
So it's not so much a question of whether it's harder or easier. It took some adjustment, but it was not a terribly long period of adjusting. No, I'm happy to be in a period now where the things that I want to do are possible, whereas in the old days it was a question of figuring out or finding, you know, those segments of time where I could accomplish the things that I had to carry out. In a way, too, I like the more leisurely pace. I mean, when I work hard, but between now I have greater opportunity to read, to do some traveling, to see friends, and just let any new ideas come up.
Do you expect to remain here in the Delaware Valley?
I think so. Of course, I do long for 70 degrees all year long, but I can't imagine pulling up stakes just for that, because there's too much of, old associations and friends and everything that goes with that.
That's good to hear. You'll be around.
Oh, I will. Absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for discussing your life and thoughts and your music with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Composer George Rockberg has been my guest, and he does live in suburban Philadelphia. He was affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania for about 23 years as chair of the music department, composer in residence, professor of humanities. He just retired from the University of Pennsylvania. His work has been performed by many symphonies. He's run several awards and is really known around the world for his music. Well, that's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on the show after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. For folks heading home right now on the Schuylkill Expressway westbound, some slowing from University out through Vine Street. Again, some slowing from the Strawberry Mansion Bridge out through City Line Avenue. The eastbound side slows from approaching Vine down through South Street. Right around Vine Street, a minor accident cleared off to the side. Caution should be used there. If you're heading out right now towards the Burlington-Bristol Bridge, they're on standby for an opening in just a few minutes. For the ship that was at the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge from 350 to 358, traffic is getting back to normal though at the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge. If you're heading out around the Art Museum circle, right at the Art Museum tunnel, which goes underneath the Art Museum, there is an accident being cleared up in there. Also an accident in Lower Merion in the Haverford section on Lancaster Avenue at Woodside Road. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Anna Russell, who has been amusing audiences for many years with her parodies of Grand Opera. And this is, I believe, her goodbye performance to Philadelphia, though I've heard that she said that before and continues to perform. She'll be with us tomorrow afternoon live at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air. Then we'll be joined by Alice Leon Motes, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. In 1933, she wrote a book called No Nice Girl Swears. It was a somewhat satiric book of self-help suggestions for girls about things like how to ward off passes, is it okay to wear makeup or smoke in public. So we'll be talking about the re-release of this 1933 book tomorrow. Then at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Joe Tarsi, who was an engineer for Cameo Parkway Records in Philadelphia and is now an engineer at Sigma Sound and has recorded many hit records on both of those labels, and we'll be hearing some of them when he joins us. This Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll be hearing from two of the people who you're very familiar with through National Public Radio, Susan Stamberg, co-host of All Things Considered, and Bob Edwards, host of Morning Edition. So that's this Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. Bob Carlin contributed to today's show. Ron Carson was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer of the show. Danny Miller, the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Daniel Zwerdling.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
The American workers don't want another Vietnam War in Central America. On this issue, Brother Kirkland, this time...
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. The presidency is the most powerful office in the free world.
I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president.
I did not undertake lightly to seek the presidency. It is not a prize or a normal object of ambition. It is the greatest office in the world.
I am sure that here in this state of West Virginia, that no one believes that I'd be a candidate for the presidency if I didn't think I could meet my oath of office. I came to the state of West Virginia, which has fewer numbers of my co-religionists than any state in the Union.
West Virginia, candidate 15 votes. Wisconsin.
Mr. Chairman, Wisconsin has 23 votes for Senator Kennedy.
Wyoming. Mr. Chairman, Wyoming's vote will make majority for Senator Kennedy. Mr. Chairman, I strike the rule that the vote be made unanimous for that great American, Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts, the next president of the United States.
Ambiguous Legacy, John Kennedy and the American Condition.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear
that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Together.
The period from the Truman administration to the Kennedy administration represents what has been called the American century, a time when American economic and military might in the world was overwhelming, and domestic ills such as labor conflicts, poverty, and unemployment were thought to be a thing of the past. The Cold War in the 1950s was at its peak, and the United States was engaged in a holy struggle against a system of government alien to the American way of life. The threat of nuclear war was a part of that way of life and on everyone's mind. Charges of espionage, subversion, and disloyalty were common. Beneath the apparent calm of the 1950s lay a cauldron of energies about to burst on the scene. Technology and automation were beginning to race ahead of our capacity to control them. Space exploration began to ignite the imagination. In the cities, rock and roll and the early beatniks appeared, along with then-obscure folk singers such as Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. In the South, a civil rights movement began to stir and gain notoriety. The activities of organized crime were headlined across the country, and John and Robert Kennedy gained national prominence in its pursuit. In 1961, the new president, John F. Kennedy, implored, "It's time to get the country moving again." Away from what he viewed with some scorn as the passive and muddle-headed policies of the outgoing Eisenhower administration. In the new frontier, the challenges of the modern world were to be met head-on and channeled into useful ends. Progress was the battle cry, and no obstacle was too great. Kennedy soon learned, however, that the reality of the world was more stubborn than he thought, that it would not bend to his will. And yet he continues to inspire us as a man of action, accomplishment, and goodwill. Many believe this to be an example of America's romance with its leaders. What are the myths and realities of Kennedy the man and, more importantly for the country, Kennedy the president? How did his policies shape the world we have known since his violent death 20 years ago? And what meaning can we derive from the unfulfilled promise of the Kennedy years?
We had four swimming pools for whites and four for Negroes. Three out of the four Negro pools far excelled all four white pools. Four and four. Now, how is this discrimination? Had a golf course formed. Cost the taxpayers $22,000 a year to subsidize it for the Negroes to play golf. Now, what is so wrong to ask them to play golf?
As early as the 1940s, Southern white segregationists had become fearful that a liberal Democratic administration in Washington would attempt to legislate an effective national policy of racial integration. In 1954, The Supreme Court ruled that legal segregation in school systems was unconstitutional, but most Southern states refused to comply. President Eisenhower declined to place his personal prestige or the prestige and authority of his office behind the ruling. He believed that legislative and judicial action was misguided and would only inflame the atmosphere, and that the way to effect change was through an appeal to reason and through prayer. In 1957, however, he was forced, reluctantly, to send federal troops into Little Rock, Arkansas, to desegregate a school. In Montgomery, Alabama, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a black woman, refused to obey the law and moved to the back of a bus. Her arrest led to a spontaneous mass protest in which Martin Luther King, Jr., a Baptist minister, emerged a leader. King was to later form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which, in concert with the Congress on Racial Equality, known as CORE, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, was to lead anti-segregation sit-ins, freedom marches, and freedom rides throughout the South in the late 1950s and early 1960s. It was in this climate in 1960 that a Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts, was elected President of the United States. Together with his brother Robert, the new Attorney General, he had to cope with the moral challenges and legal problems posed by the burgeoning civil rights movement.
Basically, the heyday of the civil rights movement did not occur during the Kennedy administration at all. It was in 64 and 65, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65. That's when the whole country was caught up in civil rights, and that did not occur during the Kennedy administration.
Taylor Branch, author of a forthcoming book about Martin Luther King, Jr.
The Kennedy administration was the civil rights movement coming up to speed. It was prologue, it was introduction, and it was a gradual process of the moral claims of the civil rights movement eating into the consciousness of the country and through the media and into politics and into Congress.
During the campaign itself, Dr. King and the other principal leaders of the movement were extremely optimistic about what a Kennedy presidency would hold.
David Garrow, professor of political science, University of North Carolina, author of The FBI and Martin Luther King.
They viewed his public promises and his private comments, he met with King twice in private during the campaign, viewed those promises as very different from what a Eisenhower or a Nixon in the White House would mean for black people. So right after Kennedy's election and in the first few months after the inauguration, Dr. King and the other leaders are extremely upbeat.
The civil rights high point of the Kennedy administration was the 1960 presidential campaign.
Victor Navasky, editor of The Nation, author of Kennedy Justice.
John Kennedy, as a candidate, made eloquent and inspiring civil rights speeches. He said the president could integrate all publicly assisted housing with a stroke of his pen by signing an executive order saying that public assistance would stop to any non-desegregated housing. And then he didn't stroke his pen for a couple of years. And I was involved with a thing called the Ink for Jack campaign. We argued they must have, the White House ran out of ink, and we urged all of our subscribers, I was putting out a little satire magazine at the time, to send a bottle of ink to the White House. And Pierre Salinger, who was in the press secretary, wrote back to tell us to stop, that they had got the message.
Kennedy was the first president during the escalating and mounting phase of the civil rights movement. That is, the Greensboro sit-ins preceded Kennedy's election of the presidency by only about 9 months.
Bruce Miroff, political scientist.
Kennedy stepped into office precisely at the moment when the movement was taking off, when it was developing its real momentum. I think the history of civil rights in the Kennedy presidency has to be understood in terms of a dynamic which the movement was responsible for and which Kennedy was reactive against. Basically, the real dynamic, the real definition of the issue of civil rights, the real moral depths of the civil rights cause, I think have to be attributed to the movement. Kennedy really, I think, gets too much credit in the eyes of many people when they identify him with Martin Luther King. I think if we want to talk about real heroism in terms of civil rights, that the heroes were not only people like King, but the kids from SNCC who put their lives on the line in the South, the very average blacks in countless communities across the South who, for the first time, were able to combat intimidation and fear and engage in public action, that what Kennedy did was in some ways to try to control and diffuse the movement, in some ways to find more modest and moderate and traditional channels for its energies. I don't think that he was unique among presidents in doing this, and I don't think he should be particularly castigated for doing this, but if there was one thing I think Kennedy can be most seriously faulted for in the area of civil rights, it's that he basically wanted it to remain an issue like other issues. He really was very uneasy with the idea of a moral issue, an issue making moral demands on people, an issue that could not be squared with pragmatic methods and managerial politics. Civil rights gave him enormous difficulty, and it was only after a great deal of pressure on him that he was able to move as far as he did. If Kennedy was educated, if he did grow in the area of civil rights, as his admirers like to claim, the educators were certainly those people in the civil rights movement who did essentially break open the issue and break open American politics in the 1960s.
John F. Kennedy was the first American president to place his office at the front of the civil rights revolution taking place in this country.
Ted Sorensen, Kennedy advisor and speechwriter.
To declare to the Congress and to the country that racial segregation and discrimination was wrong and was to be banished from our society. I think it's true that John F. Kennedy was not a leader in the civil rights movement during his years in the Congress. I think it's true that he was exceedingly cautious on the civil rights front during his first year and a half in the presidency, with good reason, because given the impossible margins he faced in the Congress, he faced defeat at the hands of Southern Democrats on all of his economic and social legislation that would be of great importance to black citizens of this country, as well as others in the lower income group. I think it's true that John F. Kennedy did not start the civil rights revolution of the early 1960s. His efforts to channel its power into the legislative and legal processes were consistent with the best interests of both this country and its black citizens. His willingness to champion the most far-reaching civil rights legislation of all time is not something that a president who was acting solely out of political instincts would have done. It's not something that a president trying to cut off the civil rights movement would have done. On the contrary, it increased the hostility toward Kennedy in the South and among more Northerners than let on, and it endangered much of the rest of his legislative program. But he believed it was the right thing to do. He had grown in his commitment to civil rights over the years, and whatever the revisionists may say, 20 years later, when we take it for granted that a black man can eat at a lunch counter and can work on the assembly line and can live in a decent neighborhood, the black leaders of 20 years ago recognized that John F. Kennedy's championing of those provisions in law and his speaking for them around the country made a tremendous difference in the life of the average black citizen of that time. And those consequences and benefits are still felt today.
Taylor Branch.
Well, I think that his legacy in the civil rights era is magnified by the circumstances of his death, because he became a martyr, and the civil rights movement emotionally and symbolically is concerned with martyrs also. I mean, the song Abraham, Martin, and John, you've got two of those people, Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, are considered civil rights martyrs, and John F. Kennedy is thrown in there because he's also a martyr and was appropriated to the civil rights cause. Kennedy contributed basically to the civil rights movement was this activism and pragmatism. They kept being faced with crises. The Freedom Rides, the Albany demonstrations. Dr. King is in jail. James Meredith.
I know. Well, we don't want to have a lot of people getting hurt or killed down there.
That's correct.
Let's get order up there, and then we can do something about Meredith.
We can surround it with plenty of officials.
Well, we've got to get somebody up there now to get order and stop the firing and the shooting. Then you and I will talk on the phone about Meredith.
Yes, we want a freedom. Yes, we want a freedom, children. Yes, we want a freedom. We want our freedom, and we want it now. Yes, we want a freedom. Yes, we want a freedom, children. Yes, we want a freedom. We want our freedom, and we want it now. Yes,
their initial response to all of those things was basically, I wish this would go away. But because they were an activist administration, when it wouldn't go away, Bobby Kennedy or Jack Kennedy would finally wind up doing something, and people remember what they did. They started off with feeling a lot of annoyance with Martin Luther King for causing problems with them in civil rights areas, but the more they got involved in civil rights, the more their respect for him grew. I think from King's point of view, President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy were moving in the right direction. King had enough of a long-term perspective that he didn't get annoyed with day-to-day disappointments. I can't tell you how many telegrams there are from Martin Luther King to Bobby Kennedy and to the Justice Department, the FBI, asking for an investigation of atrocities and violations committed in the South against civil rights workers, to which he gets a pro forma reply from the Justice Department, the Kennedy administration, saying that we can't do anything about it. And those were personally very troublesome to him. But see, the whole premise of a lot of the civil rights movement in the early 60s was that the major hope of the civil rights movement was to gain federal intervention in the South against state power. I think Dr. King took solace from the fact that the direction of the Kennedy administration was always toward getting more involved.
David Garrow.
The Kennedy administration's view of the civil rights movement was that it had a penchant for creating problems that would embarrass the country, and the Kennedys in particular, in the entire world arena. It has been said, and very correctly so, that the Kennedys, and especially Robert Kennedy's Justice Department, had a crisis-oriented approach to the movement, and they would take strong and meaningful action only when some public crisis erupted, and that their response would always be to try to quiet down and get that turmoil off the front pages and off the evening news. The Kennedys, certainly up through early 1963, did not think of themselves nor go out of their way to be identified with the movement. Both of the Kennedy brothers were very worried, in the case of Dr. King, that the FBI's repeated private allegations that King was somehow subject to some sort of subversive influence might be publicly leaked and damage King and the movement and the Kennedys' own political support for civil rights as well. The initial FBI investigation of Dr. King stemmed from information that one of King's closest political advisors, a white attorney from New York named Stanley Levison, had at one earlier time been a very important Communist Party financial functionary. The FBI had no evidence at that time, in 1961 and 1962, that Levison still retained those loyalties, but they did persuade Robert Kennedy to approve wiretaps on Levison first. And then, about 18 months later, in the fall of 1963, to approve wiretaps on Dr. King himself at his home and office in Atlanta. The actual decision to wiretap King took perhaps 4 months in time and began after repeated warnings from both Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy to King that he should sever the Levison relationship.
Bobby Kennedy's initial reaction would be, say, during the Freedom Rides, please get Dr. King, stop doing these demonstrations, and we'll go down there and work things out with the governor of Alabama before Wallace and that sort of thing, or with Ross Barnett. And what would happen would be that sometimes Dr. King would stop and slow down, and they would go down and be slapped in the face by these politicians. And every time that happened, it was a lesson to the people in the Kennedy administration that, in effect, opened their eyes to a lot of the realities of what segregation was in the South and inevitably pushed them step by step closer to Dr. King's position. President Kennedy's greatest achievement, I believe, again, was the labeling in June of 1963, went on national television after the Birmingham, Dr. King's Birmingham movement touched off demonstrations in some 900 cities across the country against segregation. He went on television and proclaimed that the civil rights issue was a moral issue and became, in effect, a moral leader to say, you know, desegregation is imperative. The segregation laws have to be struck down, not just because they're illegal and not just because we have to obey the Supreme Court, but because they are immoral.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place?
Bob Kennedy liked to think he was in command of things and liked to be in command of things in his domain, which was a very wide one, but in this area, the Justice Department was at the center of the problem of civil rights.
Harris Wofford, Kennedy aide on civil rights.
He got into an unnecessary scrap with the Civil Rights Commission because they were going head full speed ahead in holding hearings in Mississippi, and Bob Kennedy thought that would confuse things, that it would mess things up, that it wasn't according to his timing. And certainly he tried to rein in the Civil Rights Commission. They didn't try to fire the civil rights commissioners the way Reagan has, but if he could have reined in the Civil Rights Commission and controlled it, he would have liked to. He didn't succeed. Now, he couldn't control the movement. He couldn't control the Civil Rights Commission. And at every crisis from the very first weeks in office with the New Orleans school situation through the little girls being killed in Birmingham and King in the Birmingham jail, I think at every one of those crises, when Bob Kennedy was faced with a situation that he, such as the Freedom Riders, that he wished hadn't come along, his response was the kind of action that you'd want, or at least the civil rights movement would want. The Freedom Riders, he called me up, and the president called me up and said, get your friends off those buses. We have a Berlin crisis. It's not the time for that. But when they didn't get off the buses, and I knew they wouldn't and didn't try to get them off the buses, they not only moved to try to protect the lives of the Freedom Riders, but they took action so that within a year, segregation in interstate transportation was totally ended in the United States. I think the bigger story is that there was really a convergence of popular protest and public law, and that it was brought about during the Kennedy administration, and it was successful. But the nature of popular protest and a movement such as the civil rights movement is that you do create facts, you do force the issue. King had that as his central theory, that you have to bring things to a boil, that you have to promote a tension, a creative tension, that hopefully will produce a response. And in this case, it got the response.
In government or any place else, you confront situations that come up upon you, and it's not so much whether you do or you don't, but how do you react to it?
Ed Guthman of the Kennedy Justice Department.
Now, the civil rights became a major issue in the 1960s, and I think that anybody who objectively or looks at how did the Kennedy administration respond to that would say that they supported the Constitution of the United States, and then they moved through the legislative process to get legislation to redress the major grievances in the public discrimination in the public accommodations and education and in voting. Obviously, the civil rights movement wasn't co-opted. Kennedy's put their political career on the line, and they went and said and did things to support what they believed the Constitution of the United States required. They didn't back away from the challenge that came at them. They didn't try to deal with it in political terms. They tried to deal with it the test always was, what does the Constitution require? What does the orders of the court require? And how do you avoid having violence? Those were the tests, and as they moved, and they faced up to the situation, I think, a less courageous, a less innovative, and a less committed administration in the Department of Justice, and there would have been greater violence and greater trouble.
The orders of the court in the case of Meredith versus Fea are beginning to be carried out. Americans are free and sure to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. No man, however prominent or powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law.
Professor David Garrell.
As time has passed, and as time continues to pass, I think that the historical view of the Kennedy civil rights record will become more and more critical. If one views the June 1963 speech by John Kennedy and the introduction of the civil rights package at that time as the major moral watershed for John and Robert Kennedy on civil rights, it nonetheless has to be emphasized that even after that time, in the 6 months or so from June through till the assassination, that the Kennedys still had a very ambivalent, practical stance towards the movement. And two particular examples, I think, highlight that problem. First, when the civil rights leadership publicly announced plans for the March on Washington, the Kennedy brothers and their civil rights advisors tried very hard to persuade all of the leaders, and Roy Wilkins of the NAACP and Whitney Young of the National Urban League in particular, to rethink these ideas and cancel the march, because both of the Kennedys were extremely concerned that holding this sort of a gathering in Washington would hinder rather than help chances for congressional passage of the bill. However, once it became obvious that the march was going to take place in any event, the Kennedys' position switched almost literally 180 degrees overnight to one of trying to do everything possible to assist this march and make it a success, since it was going to take place in any event. The other very important story from that period of time in 1963, and it's a story that is not much heralded in the standard accounts of those years, was an indictment of the civil rights leadership in Albany, Georgia, that the Kennedy Justice Department obtained in August of 1963, on the grounds that the civil rights leadership there had boycotted and picketed the grocery store of a white juror who had voted to acquit a county sheriff in a brutality case. That indictment of the Albany leadership was viewed by the movement as the greatest betrayal by the federal government since the Kennedys had taken office. The movement was so angered by that because the administration had done almost nothing to help the civil rights cause in Albany during the protests in December of 61 and again in the summer of 62. And then for the administration finally to go out of its way to do something in Albany and to do something that helped the segregationists. John Lewis, in his, at the time, very controversial speech at the March on Washington, alluded to those Albany indictments when asking which side is the federal government and the Kennedy administration really on in the civil rights area.
The question for history is this: what was President Kennedy's relationship to the civil rights movement? Can he fairly be described as an advocate and leader of the movement, or was his administration merely responding to a crisis in an attempt to stifle or control it? What is the enduring contribution of the Kennedy presidency in the civil rights arena?
Up until now, and still in many textbooks at the present time, one sees a portrayal of the civil rights movement as a sort of emotional, spontaneous, rhetorical crusade, which was not pragmatic or calculating or political in any strategic sense. I think over time that the historical view of the movement increasingly will see civil rights forces and civil rights leaders as perceptive and sagacious and at times very calculating political actors and not simply as spontaneous participants. I think as time increasingly passes, that credit for the gains and achievements of the 1960s will pass more and more to the movement itself, and not simply to leaders such as Dr. King, but to a much broader strata of people, and that the amount of credit given to presidents or attorneys general or even the Congress will gradually decline. Most of what has been written to date about the 1960s still has a Washington-centered, government-centered, national perspective on change. And much of what has been written either has a presidential focus or focuses on SCLC and King or SNCC or the other civil rights organizations. And I think overall that scholars and journalists have very badly slighted the amount of change that took place both at that time and in the 20 years since at the local grassroots level all across the South. And it's at that local grassroots level that the real change is most meaningful and most important. In another decade or two's time, we will come to look at the impact and the message of the civil rights movement more and more from a grassroots level, as something that people did for themselves, not something that was handed to them by Washington.
If you miss me at the back of the bus, you can't find me nowhere. Oh, come on over to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there.
And one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
I'll be ruling over there. I'll be ruling over there. Oh, come on over to the city jail. I'll be ruling over there.
Go slow. Go slow. But that's just the trouble. Desegregation.
It gets worse, and for arresting people and under what charge and what legal penalties they face and so on. For example, one arrest General Walker, I don't know whether we just arrest him under disturbing the peace or whether we arrest him for more than that. I wonder, how long are you going to be at the court this morning?
You don't have to live next to me. Just give me my equality. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody knows about Alabama. Everybody knows about Mississippi.
Another major focus, some would say obsession of the Kennedy Justice Department, were organized crime and labor racketeering. Attorney General Robert Kennedy's feud with Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters Union is legend.
Attorney General Robert Kennedy paints a grim picture of the rise of lawlessness under the Cosa Nostra, or mafia. This he describes as the government of organized gambling, narcotics peddling, extortion, racketeering, and controlling of certain trade unions. He says the income runs into billions. These hearings always attract a large number of spectators. This one is particularly crowded, awaiting the first public appearance of Joseph Vellacki, the convicted hoodlum whose confession...
What is organized crime, and how widespread is its influence? What techniques are used to undermine its activities, and are they warranted? These are the questions raised by the history of the prosecution of organized crime in America, most notably under the Kennedy administration. Debate persists today between those who view organized crime as a serious threat and those who deny or belittle its power and criticize the methods employed to combat it. These questions are addressed by Dan Muldea, author of The Hoffa Wars, Ralph Salerno, national consultant on organized crime, and Ramsey Clark, former attorney general.
Well, the mob has always been an organized conspiracy of criminals who are operating for the purposes of making money and staying out of jail.
Today, organized crime is in a wide variety of businesses. I think if you want to understand some of the impact of organized crime, you have to read a five-part series done by Forbes magazine, a responsible financial journal, which tells us that in gross dollars, it's second only to the oil industry, and in net profit, it surpasses any other industry in this country.
Gambling is still probably the principal income of organized crime, and gambling on professional football would be an example of very lucrative gambling operations by organized crime. Whenever a NFL game is televised, gambling on that nationally televised game goes up by $600 million.
Some people have said its take is tens of billions annually or more, and that it controls whole cities and the rest. That sort of statement is patently absurd.
Organized crime